Hi, everyone. This is Celeste Duckworth, and this is Vertical Live Radio. And we're featuring our Taste of Ink program, where today's featured guest is Melissa Studdard. Melissa Studdard is the author of the poetry collection, I Ate the Cosmos for Breakfast, and the young adult novel, 6 Weeks to Yehida. Her short writings have appeared in a wide variety of journals, magazines, blogs, and anthologies such as Psychology Today, The Guardian, Southern Humanities Review, Harvard Review, Bettering American Poetry, and Poets and Writers. In addition to writing, she serves as executive producer and host of VITA, Voices and Views for VITA, Women in Literary Arts, president of the Associated Writing Program's Women's Caucus, and an editor for American Micro Reviews and Interviews. She received her MFA from Sarah Lawrence Eve College and is a professor for the Lone Star College System. Her awards include the Forward National Literature Award, the International Book Award, the Reader's Favorite Awards, and others. And we are so pleased to have Melissa with us today at A Taste of Ink. I just want to say today to thank my team, the Vertical Life team. Thank you so much for putting this program together for me. And also, I just want to thank you for our quote today. We have a really nice quote today that I'd like to share with the audience. And our quote before we go into talking with Melissa, I'd like to give our guests some time to call in. Our quote today is really, I really like it, team. I really like it. So our quote is, my role in society or any artist or poet's role is to try and express what we all feel, not to tell people how to feel, not as a preacher, not as a leader, but as a reflection of us all. And that great quote comes from John Lennon. And again, team, thank you so much for helping put things together for me. Coming to Georgia for the summer was quite an experience. So I'd like to introduce you again to Melissa Studdard. I'd like to welcome Melissa to our program. How are you today, Melissa?
Hi, I'm wonderful. How are you doing?
Great. I am great. So I'm happy to have you on the program today. I've been watching what you've been doing. So it's really I was really glad that you said yes and you had time to be on the program today.
Well, thank you. I really appreciate you hosting me.
Well, I asked Melissa to start us out by reading a poem. I wanted her to read I Ate the Cosmos for Breakfast. And then we can go into our interview and talk a little bit about that poem. So, Melissa?
Okay, I'd be delighted. I ate the cosmos for breakfast. It looked like a pancake, but it was creation flattened out. The fist of God on a head of wheat, milk, the unborn child of an unsuspecting chicken, all beaten to batter and drizzled into a pan. I brewed some tea and closed my eyes while I ate the sun, the air, the rain, photosynthesis on a plate. I ate the time it took that chicken to bear and lay her egg and the energy a cow takes to lactate a cup of milk. I thought of the farmers, the truck drivers, the grocers, the people who made the bag that stored the wheat, and my labor over the stove seemed short, and the pancake tasted good, and I was thankful.
Good. Great. I actually really love that poem. I was it's one of those poems you kind of read and you just kind of take your time and you read it again and you just kind of reflect on each one. And the more I read it, it was like, you know, I really like this poem. So I was like, this has to be the first one that Melissa reads to us. So I wanted to start out, what was going on with you? What were your thoughts when you wrote that poem?
Well, you know, actually, I had been reading a lot at that time of a lot of like Buddhist nonfiction, and I was reading a book by Thich Nhat Hanh. I don't know if you know him. He's a Vietnamese Buddhist philosopher, and the concepts were things that he was talking about in his book. And basically, the idea is that whatever we take into our body is it's let me see how to put this. Like, our first of all, our diet is more than what we physically eat. You know, it's also what we take
right.
in terms of media and all of that. So there's that in there, but then also the idea that you know, when we eat something, we're not just eating, you know, a pancake is not just a pancake. It is
right.
everything that went to what created that pancake. So in addition to eating like a physical substance, we're also eating energy. So I really
mm-hmm.
wanted to sort of convey that in the poem. And it's, I mean, you know, not to get preachy or anything, but I'm a vegetarian, and that's one of the reasons that I don't like to eat meat is because I don't want to eat, you know, that energy of suffering
mm-hmm.
in addition to,
mm-hmm.
you know, about animals and just not liking meat, like, so.
No, you actually encaptured that thought very well in your poem. I totally understand that. Yes, I totally get that. We know there's a lot of indigenous people that believe that, you know, when you're eating meat or you're eating something in nature, you're taking in that the spirit of that particular entity or ingredient, you know. So I totally got that. I totally got that.
Yeah, thank you.
So.
And I think also in there is the idea that, you know, that just the interconnectivity of life and various things, you know,
mm-hmm.
which is why I wanted to bring in the truck drivers and, you know, the elemental aspects like the sun and the air and the rain. So.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So tell us a little bit about growing up, Melissa. Where did you grow up at and what was family life like?
I grew up in Houston, Texas, really
okay.
more in a suburb. So it's Texas is a really interesting place, as I'm sure a lot of people know. it's not exactly, I think, how people perceive it, though, because,
uh-huh.
yes, we do have the sort of cowboy culture and all of that, but it's really oddly mixed with a really great culture and arts scene in Houston. You know, we have
mm-hmm.
a great opera. It's a wonderful literary
mm-hmm.
scene. So it was this very, very strange mix of opposites that were somehow
mm-hmm.
simultaneously coexisting. And my family life was pretty normal, I think, for that time period.
Uh-huh.
My parents were still married, and my mom was a stay-at-home mom, and she really nurtured. I had one sister and a bunch of pets, and my mom just was always there for us and nurturing us. And
mm-hmm.
You know, it's a good home life.
mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. how were you inspired to write poetry? Did you read a lot? Or I did read in one article about you that your family, where you come from a family of storytellers, and so was that partly and what inspired you to do poetry?
Yeah, I mean, I think when I first started writing, I didn't necessarily set out to become a poet. I think that sort of happened during the process. But I did
uh-huh.
grow up in a household of storytellers. And, you know, my mom would always just, whenever the family was together, she would be telling stories. And it was really funny because,
even if it was a story that we had all heard before, she would still tell it. So she might start out a story, but she might say something like, did I ever tell you about the time? And we'd all say, yes. And then she'd go, well, anyway. And she would just keep going and tell the story. And every time she told it, it got a little more interesting. It just got more detail. And I wouldn't say that she necessarily changed it. It was the same basic facts every time. It wasn't like she was embellishing in the sense of turning it into a tall tale, but she would just start adding more and more details. And so I was kind of watching her craft these things live over the years, just out of her own instinct. You know, I think both of my parents should have written as well. But so there was that. And then my grandparents, I grew up in a family that loved words and storytelling. And when the family was together, we would, you know, play Scrabble, and my grandparents were always talking about different words that they learned and what they were reading. And I was always reading. I mean, I remember over like spring break, my junior year of high school, I was reading War and Peace, and everybody was teasing me like, oh, a little light reading for spring break. But that's just how I grew up. So I didn't really, I didn't watch a lot of TV for whatever reason. And I still kind of don't. But yeah, and then I went into grad school initially as a lit major, not as a creative writing major, but I happened to go to a school where there was a really, really great writing program. So I was surrounded by writers, and that was kind of the first time that it ever really occurred to me that I could be a writer, because before that point I was a reader and I loved reading, but I think because a lot of the stuff that I was reading was by these, you know, literary giants who had been dead for hundreds of years. It just didn't occur to me, really. Oddly enough, this is something that people actually do now. So I was like, oh, I can write too. And I do write both fiction and poetry. But at that time I was writing more fiction. And then I think what happened is I started reading a lot of contemporary poetry. And when I started reading contemporary poetry, then I was really kind of ignited and excited by it in a way that I wasn't as much from the older poetry. And that's when I started also writing poems. And one other thing is just that I've been a single parent for like a very long time now, like 18 years. And I have time to write poems. It's a little harder to write a novel when you're working full time and parenting and all of that. So, I kind of by default, I went towards poetry. But I love poetry. Like I love it, like the way other people love a person. You know? So.
Are there any specific type of poetry that you like, or more than any other, or?
You know, I love any poem that is functioning well, and I think each poem is its own sort of animal, in the sense that whatever is going on with that poem in terms of what it's trying to convey or express will call for a different kind of form or voice or image. But having said that, I do find myself drawn the most to poems that are highly imaginative, in the sense that they've got some either surreal aspect, or they have a lot going on with metaphor, or something that sort of transcends beyond our everyday perception of reality. And I think that I read poetry really for two different things, and not just poetry, but fiction as well. I want I want that human connection. I want those moments when I'm reading and I say, oh my gosh, that's it. That's exactly what I think or how I feel or how the world is, but I just had never really realized I was thinking that. It's like the writer is voicing your truths. And then also for those moments of magic where you just feel sort of transported from your normal perception into this unusual perception of something through a metaphor or some other sort of surreal or poetic device.
So who is I would say, give me three of your favorite poets.
That is so hard. Oh my gosh, because I love so I love so many poets. I think, you know, easier than specifically calling out individual poets, what I'd like to do is sort of point out schools of poetry. For instance, I love the Latin American poets like Neruda and Viejo. And, you know, I love that whole, like, sort of group. I also love a contemporary poet, Ilya Kamenskij's work. Gosh, who else do I like? I've always liked Anne Sexton. I know her work is kind of dark, but but, you know, just her, the way her mind worked, it was like she was putting this incredible, unusual mind just bare on the page for you. I love Audre Lorde. Yeah, it's just so many.
right.
Yeah, how about you? Who do you like?
Oh my gosh, probably the same like you. I do like, I like poems that can take you places. You know, I love poems that are cultural based. I just heard some work by I can't even pronounce her name, but she is from she's from Pakistan, and I really loved the way the poetry was written. And I think I love to hear poetry in Spanish. And I love anything that's a little bit, very little bit, but I love to listen to it. I just, you know, I love to listen to it. It just puts me in a really great mood. And I do love poems that are political, that make a statement. Especially because I do think that poetry is, it really is kind of the heartbeat of life, I think. I think that poets are gifted, you know, I think poets are kind of gifted with the ability to give messages. And so I like anything that's really giving a message or telling a story. And, you know, of course, all of us, I think all poets have some sort of dark in them that, you know, it was funny. I read a poem and someone said, oh, God, that's so sad. I'm like, actually, it's not really sad. But I think we just have that weird way that we interpret things, you know. You know, I get a kick out of that. Yeah, I do get a kick out of that. So what has been your biggest challenge and I would say in the beginning to write poetry, what has been your biggest challenge?
You mean now or when I was younger and first
when
starting?
When you were younger, when you were younger, what was your biggest challenge?
I'm trying to think back then what it would have been. I mean, I think just traditionally it's always been time. I haven't had a lot of time. I've always worked a lot. Back then I didn't have a child yet, but I was, you know, I was really involved in graduate school and various things. So I think that's been the biggest issue for me. I think I can't really think of anything else that's been like a block or anything like that.
Right. And I can certainly relate to the part of, I can certainly relate to time. I was reading that you were saying that sometimes when you have an idea, it could take you a long time. It could, you know, it's incubating. So what would you say that was your longest time to write a poem?
That's an excellent question, and I have to say it depends on what you consider the beginning of writing something. If you think of that as the conceptualizing the idea of what you want to write about, I would say the longest has been literally about probably 14 years. Yeah. So there was one poem that I conceptualized shortly after my daughter was born, and then I wasn't working on it the whole time, but it was just there brewing in the back of my mind that whole time. And then once I got enough distance from that and she got a little older, I was able to finally write about it. And, you know, then on the flip side, I've had poems that I've just written in 15 minutes, you know, there's a really extreme range in there of how long it could take for any poem. So, and I think one of the things that's interesting is, and I want to say I wasn't actively working on the one poem the whole time, but it was there. I knew I wanted to write it, and I had tried a few different times at different points in my life to write it and just was unable. And it was sort of brewing. And then I do want to say, though, the poems that we work on, that we're really actively working on and fiddling with, sometimes the ones that come harder, that take longer to write and take more revision and are more difficult, actually make the other ones come more easily. Like, I find that I sometimes idea that I'm trying to express, and I may take a week working on this one poem and just revisiting it every day and tinkering with it, and it just feels so difficult. And then when I finish that poem, usually another poem will just flow out quickly. And I don't know exactly what that's about, but it's definitely a pattern. And I've heard a lot of other poets say the same thing.
Yeah, I write poetry, and that happens to me sometimes. I think I think what you said that too. I don't feel so bad though when you said 14 years. I was like, okay, I'm in good company.
Oh, thank you.
I started writing poetry pretty late. Everyone in my family is writers, and they were even my. In fact, it was funny because my daughter was saying something about how she's waiting for the day that her daughter's gonna say that word to her and make her cry. And I thought about when she was 8 years old, I happened to see something she wrote in her room, and I was like, oh my gosh, she said that about me. And my oldest daughter says, yeah, and I said to my oldest daughter, how come you don't, I never hear you cuss or say things. She goes, no, Mom, I write poetry. So I was like, huh.
But my daughter's a writer too, so I understand.
Oh, good. How does that make you feel that she's a writer? You know, does she let you read her work or anything like that?
She does, and it's wonderful. Yeah, I'm so happy for her. She is actually in college now, and she is majoring in creative writing, and she's very involved. She's on the undergraduate literary magazine. She's part of a literary collective. Right now she's taking a creative writing class over the summer at the college, and she lets me read her assignments before she turns them in. So it's a lot of fun. I love it because in addition to whatever home life we have also this in common. So we share this great love. It's wonderful.
That's good, because I think also, too, you know, sharing that great love, you also share that it's kind of a camaraderie of not feeling that I know sometimes – I kind of feel that I'm trying to share that space or have the space without someone feeling that you're kind of locking them out for a few moments, that they kind of understand. They understand that time and space that you get into when you're writing. So I think that's kind of neat that both of you are writers, because you have that kind of inward thing.
Yeah, that's a really good point. And also I did not write for many years, and I didn't, like, when I finished my MFA, and then I started a full-time job. I have my child, and I got divorced when she was two. So from that point forward, I was working a lot and, you know, bringing her up and everything. And I didn't want, I felt guilty. I didn't want to be away from her and take the time away from her. So I didn't write literally for about 8 or 10 years. And it was really hard. I mean, it felt like a piece of me was missing. And I could never do that now. You know, I could never do that now because I love it so much now. But when she started really becoming interested in writing, she gave it back to me, you know. Felt like, okay, this is something that we do together, that we share together. We always read together, and she was always interested in writing. But when she got really, really legitimately involved in it, that's when it sort of freed me up to feel comfortable doing it, because we would share our work.
That's really good. I find that sometimes family or your children are kind of like the invisible sponges. They remember things about you and they give it back to you later on, which is really neat.
Beautiful. It really is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. How do you designate time to write, or what is the best writing environment for you?
I actually put it on my calendar, because if I don't, then I will just book myself up and schedule all these different things. But I block off time on my calendar each week, and that way I think you start to think of it as being as important as everything else in your life, because I think people have a tendency, oh, it's just writing, I can do it whenever, and then the time just slips away. I mean, a day can slip away very quickly with a lot of things that don't really matter if you're scheduling like a doctor's appointment for next week, and you look at your calendar and you have writing blocked off on Tuesday from 10 to noon, and then you will not schedule a doctor's appointment during that time. And I've found that that's pretty much what I've had to start doing. And as far as the environment goes, I can write pretty much anywhere, but I definitely prefer being alone when I'm writing. I'm not someone who loves to go sit in coffee shops and write or anything like that. I like to be surrounded by my own books and playing my own music, and it's kind of odd. I don't know if I've ever told anybody this before, but I like to dance when I write, which would not go over that well at a coffee shop, or maybe it would go over pretty well. I don't know. But I mean, I will literally be writing, and then if I could write like a stanza, and then if I feel stuck, I just blast some music I like and dance for 2 or 3 songs, and then I go back and I'm writing it, like an intertwined sort of inspiration.
Yes. I get that. I love that you block off a calendar. Do you get excited when you see that day getting closer?
I do, and I recently started using Google Calendars, so you can block things out in different colors, and I made light purple my me time color, so whenever I see that light purple, I'm just like, oh, I get to write or meditate or, you know, do whatever it is that I'm really excited about. And I want to say, I don't only write when I have that time blocked out. I write a lot more. The time that I actually block out to write. It's just that is like a safeguard to make sure that I, no matter how busy I get, I will do some writing that week. But a lot of times I'll get right first thing in the morning. In fact, I try to do that as frequently as I can. Aside what time I have blocked out, I just try to get up and get straight to my own writing instead of getting too carried away with social media or all the other responsibilities and things that a day brings. And then at the end of the day, if I have time left over, I will often write in the evenings as well.
And I get that. I get that as well. I had to create my calendar, because it's very easy, especially when you love what you do, it's very easy to get caught up in the time. You're right. And, you know, and I'll just go and go and go and go. So I had to do my own calendar this year, so I do get that. It's kind of interesting. Yeah, it's just sometimes you just look up and you're like, oh my goodness, it's, you know, where has a day gone? So, and when you're in media, and I know you understand this, when you're in media, any type of media and communication, that can really suck your time. It just can take your time. Yeah, it really can take your time. So how did it feel to see I Ate the Cosmos for Breakfast in a movie form?
Oh, I loved it. And I love the movie, too. I knew that they were making a film, but I had no idea what they were doing with it at all. All I knew was that they were making a film. So I saw it for the first time, blown away by it. I love the fact that the imagery that they chose doesn't reflect the imagery in the poem in a literal way. So there are no pancakes or syrup or coffee houses or anything like that. It goes back to the elemental aspects that I was talking about earlier with the air and the sun. So I feel like it would be easy for a filmmaker to take a poem and just represent the poem, but I feel like what they did was added another entire dimension to the art. So it became its own thing as a film, but I feel like they understood the deepest meanings of the poem rather than the surface meanings, and it was just absolutely wonderful.
Yes, it was, right. And that's what I thought. I was like, oh, she must have been really thrilled when this came out, because it just was really nice. Yeah, it was really nice.
I was. And they filmed that in the rainforest in Puerto Rico. So even the location.
Well, that's the other thing, too. Well, when you were talking about that they didn't do it just literally, when we were talking in the beginning, when you talked about, you know, the reason you wrote this and what the meaning was, they actually captured that, you know, and I was thinking, this is kind of cool. I said, and you think about these, these indigenous people that actually have that belief. And I was like, this is actually very nice. So, kudos to who wrote that, designed that film for you. I thought it was very, very good.
Yeah, that was Dan Sickles. He's with the Moxie film. Did it for motion film.
All right. So let me ask you, I do want you to do this another poem, because I'm finally, I'm going through your poetry. I'm like, oh, man, I really like this one. I wanted to do this one. Like, we could do the whole show of poetry, too. You know, we'll have to have you back and just do poetry.
That'd be nice.
Do you think there is a resurgence of interest in poetry right now?
That's a really difficult question. We keep hearing that there is. And, there have been all kinds of articles about it, and people are saying that. I think with social media, there are a lot of things that people maybe have always been interested in, but now are just getting circulated a lot more. So it's kind of hard to say, but I think it's certainly possible that people, because with social media, people are posting poems all the time, and a lot of times something will happen and somebody will post a poem in response or a few lines from a poem to try to capture the feeling of what's going on in the country or in the news. So in that sense, I think that people are more interested in having poetry speak for them. So I think maybe there is. I mean, there's certainly more interest in it, it seems. It's kind of hard for me to say, because my friends and I have always been interested in poetry. So it looks the same to me as it always has. I remember even in high school, I had a group of friends who would pass around like a ring binder notebook, and people would just write poems in it, and it just went around and around. And so that's been my experience. But it seems like there's more visibility for it now. And maybe people who weren't interested in it before are seeing it and being exposed more to contemporary poems. Because I think one of the issues with poetry that has been problematic in the past is that the way it has been taught in schools in the past has been...
Okay.
Just, you know, sort of, and this is no fault to the school teachers, because I know everybody's teaching for the test and whatever, but
right,
you know,
right,
the curriculum has mainly included, you know, you're reading like Shakespeare and Wordsworth and all these old white dead guys who spoke in a language that we don't speak anymore, and the syntax was strange. And I mean, don't get me wrong, I love strange syntax. Now I think there is a push towards having living poets come to schools and assigning contemporary mm-hmm. poetry. And I think if there's mm-hmm. something that it's making a change and creating a renewed interest in it, I think it's probably that.
Okay.
People are
right.
hearing poetry
right.
and thinking, this is what's going on in my life now, or this is how I feel,
mm-hmm.
or this is in a language that sounds like the language that my friends and I actually speak.
Right.
And it's also
right.
more representative in terms of you know, race, gender, all of that. So that's very helpful
mm-hmm.
too. People can identify
mm-hmm.
with it more. They're with more poems being, you know, represented by more people, then they can find themselves in that.
Right, right. And then I think, so like you said as well, the whole idea with social media, one of the things when I first got on Facebook because I wanted to be surrounded literally by people that were poets and writers, and I purposely friended every author
mm-hmm.
and poet I knew. And so, you know, like you, for me, it's like it's always been there, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I think that, but as far as you're right, you know, I read the articles about the resurgence of interest. I think it's more that we're in front of people. In
mm-hmm.
a way that's not just cafes, you know, we're in front of people with social media.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it was always there as well, but it just seems, and I know we grew up with poetry in my family. I mean, writers and poets and having to recite poems and, you know, my grandfather reciting poems, and, you know, I'm always amazed at how my aunt and them can drop a long poem and remember all the words. I'm always
wow.
amazed at that, you know. So,
yeah.
And you know, we used to have to recite in school. So, yeah, I think it's more that we're really in front of people more than before. Social
mm-hmm.
media puts us right there in front of them. It puts us right there in their room, in their living room, and the ability to speak other people's languages as well through poetry. So, I think it's more that as well. Okay, so
yeah, I think that's a good point.
I'm going to read a poem.
Okay, sure.
Tell me about Revolution, because that's the one I picked for you to read, and I really I got a whole lot out of that. So I want you to tell me what you were thinking when you wrote that poem, and then we're going to hear Revolution by Melissa Studdard.
Okay, thank you. That's actually one of the poems that came more quickly for me. I just sort
okay.
of sat down and wrote it. I think it came from a lot of things that I had been thinking and feeling that just kind of built up and spilled over. So I had been thinking a lot about consumerism and just the way you know, we live in this sort of consumerist society, because I'm
mm-hmm.
I don't like it, to be honest.
Yeah, okay.
I'm not a fan of consumerism, so I just feel like there's too much attention on buying things and eating things and taking things, and there should be a lot more. People should be focused, or people, I shouldn't say people, all of us should be focused more on what we can make and what we can give. And it just feels
mm-hmm.
like something that we've gotten sort of trapped inside without thinking about it enough. So, you know, making these choices. So I was thinking about that a lot and thinking about how I'm complicit in that and what I can do to change that. And then I started sort of relating that in my mind to patriarchal values and, you know, thinking of myself as a sort of wild woman trying to step outside of that. And, and so that's where the poem came from.
Okay.
So I'll read it. Revolution. Democracy is a pigeon looking for a landing. Consumerism is an accident from when God fell asleep. Now the skyline is inside me like a door leading to someone else's bedroom. Nothing on the dresser is mine. The ornate gold frames hold other people's children. The jewelry box, someone else's jade. I move across the carpet in my slippers and mist, a myth not yet written. What it is I want to become, no man can answer or buy. It's possible I'm the mother of vast, dark silences. It's possible I will grandparent a litter of storms.
Okay. I love that. I love that.
Oh, thank you. Well, you can see that like one of the things. I think one of the things that, you know, in the middle of the poem, I didn't really realize it until you had me read it just now, but I think in the middle there when I'm talking about how nothing on the dresser is mine and it's like a door leading to someone else's bedroom, I'm thinking there about how consumerism kind of separates us from ourselves. You know, because when we're going around, like, you know, we don't know who we are when, you know, let's say, and I've done this, we've all done this. In fact, I did this probably three nights ago. I was upset about something and I didn't want to face it or deal with it or just sit down and touch it. I just went shopping on the way home and, you know, spent an hour at the store making myself feel better. But what that did is, yeah, it was like a temporary fix, but it didn't really solve the problem and I didn't really deal with what was bothering me. And that's kind of where I am in the middle of that poem. When I'm doing that, I'm not in touch with myself. And then so it sort of goes from, you know, the poem sort of moves from recognizing the problem to being like really deeply inside the problem to trying to step out of it, which is becoming new, but also kind of a return to myth and more primal ways of being.
I can, and you know what, that's a good point you made too, like when you're thinking of something or, and it's kind of funny how certain things trigger us. We'll say, oh, we're going to go to the store or whatnot and just make us feel better. In the end, it doesn't make you feel better. You go and it's like you get something and then you're at home when you're at home and you're looking at it like, why did I get that? So, because you're trying to avoid the issue. Right.
Well, I'm a horrible shopper. I actually usually hate shopping, and people will be like, in my family or, you know, friends from when I was younger will be like, let's go make a day of shopping. And I'm like, oh my God, I can't imagine anything I would rather not do. But then like spontaneously when I'm driving home and I'm feeling bad about something, I'm like, I just find myself, you know, I feel myself sort of pulled in to go into the store and and buy something. I'm actually looking at it right now. It's a huge mirror for my office. It's like 6 feet long. I'm looking at this thing going, wow. But I'm actually glad I have it.
Doing that one time, and I'm like you. I don't like shopping, and it was funny. It's like I got into the mall, and I was like, what are you doing here? You're going to pass out here at the mall. It's funny that you said that. So let me ask you, when it comes to marketing yourself or getting yourself out here in front of, you know, crowds or going to different events, do you do all of that yourself or do you have someone that helps you with that?
No, I don't really have anyone who helps me. I would love to, though, if anybody's listening and wants to help me. I'm not good at it. I'm so not good at it. I mean, I don't know, maybe I am good at it. I shouldn't say that about myself, but I'm not, mm-hmm. I'm not mm-hmm. here for the marketing. I'm here because I love poetry and I love,
right.
you know, reading and writing. And it's interesting. I think before we have our first book published, so many authors sort of have this ideal in our mind about how it'll be after it's published. And mm-hmm. but then once the first book comes out, you're just, I mean, for me anyway, and I think a lot of people, you're just thinking, oh, you know what, the greatest part of it was actually writing it. You know,
right.
That's what you wanted to spend your time writing. Although I will say I do love things that bring me together with other people. Like I love doing mm-hmm. festivals and readings and like talking mm-hmm. to people, like you and I are talking right now, especially when it's another poet like mm-hmm. you. You know, it's right. I love that aspect of it. So I love the writing, and then I love the connection and the events, but I'm not mm-hmm. I don't like the planning and all of the stuff that goes around it. It just feels like, oh, I'm busy scheduling all these different things, and I could be writing or like being at an event or whatever. So you know, mm-hmm. mostly I don't really do anything. I can't think of anything that I really seek out that much. Usually, you know, like you contacted me and I was like, oh yeah, that's wonderful. Mm-hmm. I'd love to do that. So I'm not actively, or I haven't been at least lately, actively pursuing anything. So,
right.
you know, maybe, but it's been a little while since my last book came out too. So maybe that'll change when the next book comes out. So.
Yeah, I find that when I'm, you know, I talk to a lot of authors and poets, and marketing is probably the most, I think, confusing, hard thing. I've learned, you know, I love it, but we never market ourselves as well as we market other things and other people.
It's
you know,
so much
and
easier.
So,
yeah.
Yes, it really is very. It's easier to do other people, and I. And if you I'm not really like that. It's I met my fiance, who owned our magazine, and when I first met him, he published my poetry, and he really liked my poetry, and it was funny because when he asked me to come to work, I was like, yeah, I don't think I want to work for you, and it was kind of like no. And some of my friends are like, no, this is a good job for you because it's, you know, it's in media and, you know, you're in there. And I'm like, okay. And then he used to say, you know, because you're going to go to all these meetings and you're going to be out in front. I'm like, hold it. Wait a minute. No. that's the wrong person there, you know. But
yeah.
It's very easy to market other people. It's very hard to market yourself. That's the one thing I have learned as common between a lot of poets and writers. How do you feel about being on social media and having yourself out there and talking about what you do, or you know, when you have other entities having you, you know, on their programs or in their magazines? How do you feel about putting that out on social media?
Yeah, before I get to that, I want to kind of respond to what you said a minute ago, too, because I think it mm-hmm. is important to sort of recognize that it is easier
okay.
to market other people, because I think when we, or at least for me, when I'm marketing other people, I'm not thinking of it as marketing. I'm just thinking of it as sharing something that I love. And I think
right.
particularly, or I think a lot of us, and me as a woman in the South, I was brought up to be modest. So, you know, quote unquote, marketing myself feels inappropriate. It feels like bragging. It feels like showing off. Even when someone asks me for a bio for something, I'm like, oh God, can someone else write that? You know, like, I don't want to list my accomplishments. That sounds like bragging.
Right.
So I think that's part of the difficulty of that. And I think as far as, you know, quote unquote, marketing myself goes, I think if whenever I can reconceptualize that as just sharing myself or sharing my work or sharing with mm-hmm. others, then it becomes a lot more pleasurable. I think when I think of it as marketing, it becomes a chore, it feels embarrassing, it's, you know, so there's that. As far as social media goes, I actually really, really love social media. I've met mm-hmm. so many wonderful people. You know, mm-hmm. a lot of the people who I have in my life now who I just absolutely love came mm-hmm. from social mm-hmm. media. So it's just, it's an extension. You know, we meet people in what they call IRL, in real life, who you know, we connect with in certain ways, and it's the same in social media. And I'm delighted to be surrounded both in real life and in social media by people who share common interests and people who are mm-hmm. who I believe in, and I believe in them mm-hmm. and their work. And so I think it's a wonderful thing. I do think that I have to limit it. I think that we all have to limit it in yes. terms of time and how much energy we give to it, because in a lot of ways social media can become a creative act if you're putting a lot of attention into how you phrase something or what you post and how you reply to people and all of that. And it's the same with for me with several different things I'm balancing in my life, because I also mm-hmm. teach at a college. So with okay. teaching, media, writing, you know, it. I was talking to a friend the other day who was saying that these things actually come from the same well or the same resource. We're using the yes. same kind of energy yes. to do all of these things. So mm-hmm. it's really important to strive for balance in those things. And I find that sometimes I can become imbalanced. I'm writing way too much, and I realize that my friends feel neglected, or I'm spending too much mm-hmm. time in social media, but I'm not creating anything, or I'm just so focused on my teaching that, you mm-hmm. know, it's just like it's consuming me to the point that I'm not doing my own writing and stuff. So I just mm-hmm. have to, and it's not something where you can, I mean, for me, I don't know how it is for other people, but for me, it's not something where I can just lay out a plan and say, this is how it's going to be, and this is yes. it's just set now and I'm okay. It's something that has to be constantly recalibrated and recalibrated and recalibrated
mm-hmm.
As things change in your life. So, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, tell me about, I want to know about Vita. It was interesting, you know, reading information, and I said, oh, Vita. So tell us about Vita and why it's important to the arts.
Sure. Vita is actually, it's an organization that I volunteer for, and it's a nonprofit feminist organization, and its goal is to create transparency around the lack of gender parity in the literary landscape, and also mm-hmm. to by historically marginalized voices, so people of color, writers with disabilities, queer, trans, gender nonconforming people. So that's the mission. And then mm-hmm. It also has like three sort of manifestations. It has the Review, mm-hmm. which is a publication that it's not poetry and fiction. It's reports, essays, interviews, reviews. It has the Count, which is how it originally mm-hmm. started. Oh, and I want to say before I move on to the Count that my program, Vita Voices and Views, which is an interview podcast, is part of the Vita Review. And then right. the Count is how it all started, which is with people literally sitting down and counting the bylines in the most visible magazines. So using this concrete evidence of numbers to point out the disparity and the inequalities mm-hmm. in the publishing world. And then also Vita has events, which, you know, panels, presentations, readings, all of that. So it's been, in my view, and to a lot of people, it's been an incredibly important thing in the publishing world, because it has caused a lot of people to really start paying attention to their own numbers and mm-hmm. who they're publishing, and you know, when we start paying attention to things like that, obviously we do better at them. So I think initially it was just showing that this is an issue and this is something that we really need to care about and work on. And I will say a lot of magazines are really working on it. So it's been a great thing.
Okay, good. Well, the other question I have for you is, like I got off in there. What is your favorite thing to do when you're not writing, when it's just totally something that you like to do that has nothing to do with writing or, just, you know, just what is it?
Yeah, you know, it's funny when you first, I went through all these different emotions when you asked that question. When you first said, what is your favorite? I was like, oh God, no, not a favorite again. I can't do favorites again. You know, because your mind blanks out. Like, who's your favorite writer? Oh my God, I don't know. I sit around and read all day long, but you ask me who my favorite writer is, I have no idea. And then you got to the next part, and I was like, oh, I'll say writing. And then, because I heard you say to do. And then you said, when you're not writing. And then I was back in my panic again, like, oh my God, no, what do I do? I can't exactly tell you one thing, but I can tell you three or four things that I really love doing. I obviously love spending time with family and friends. That's at the top of the list. And however that manifests, you know, whatever we end up doing, I love doing that. And then I love gardening. I don't do it often enough, but I just feel sort of in my bliss when I'm out in the yard, and it's very, 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 very hot in Texas, so I don't do it as often as I'd like to. But when the weather's nice, and I like that. I love dancing, as I mentioned, and I never had I had dance classes when I was like 5 years old, and I took ballet.
Right.
And then the ballet teacher was really, really mean. And I lived in a small area where there was only one dance studio. So my parents took me out because she was always yelling at the little girls and making them cry. So I got pulled out of that, and I never got back into dance again. And now, all these years later, I've started taking dance lessons. I'm taking belly dancing lessons. So I love dancing. Yeah, I just feel completely, like, when I do it, I feel completely, like, everything that I'm worried about and stressed about, it just falls away. Like, I find that when I walk into the class and I see the instructor there, like, I just instantly start smiling. Like, when the song starts and the dance starts, like, we're all, like, smiling. It's so much fun.
That's great.
Yeah, and I'm thinking now that I'm starting to do that and it's a new thing for me, I mean, that's going to also start finding its way into my poetry, I'm sure. But I do think that's important for those of us who are so in our heads, reading and writing all the time, to find physical, you know, this is why your question is so important. It is so important to find physical things out to do in the world, because I think there were many years when I just kind of forgot I had a body. I was just like this big walking brain who read and wrote poems and taught classes. And I'm like, wait a minute, you know, I've got to get back to my body here. And I do yoga and other, you know, exercises.
Yeah, I did. I get that. I had to really pull myself. It's actually going through a transition of pulling my creative side, just kind of pulling it out. It's, you know, after working for so long, and I mean, I love the work that I do, but it's work that, like you said, you're in your head all the time. And so another reason that I started getting out and doing hiking again, because I, you know, for a whole year, I hurt my leg when I was jogging once, so I was out for a whole year. So now it's really fun because I'm hiking and I'm making all these, you know, I'm like, oh man, I'm hiking. What is my ultimate challenge going to be? But it's kind of fun because my daughter is my accountability partner, and I'm like, we'll start walking, and then we'll start laughing about where we're going to hike to, and then we'll just stand there and be laughing. And then she'll like, okay, we got to get serious, you know. So it's actually just a lot of fun for me too, you know, just being out laughing and just, you know, not thinking about anything else, and just, you know, having fun. So, yeah, I get that. I would love to learn dancing. I just think I'm a little too clumsy for that right now.
Well, I am too, but if you find the right place, they don't care. they'll just support you anyway, you know. Because I'm sure,
good,
I mean, I
good.
Know after all these years of not having a class or anything, I'm sure I know I'm the worst person in there, and they're just sweet to me and they don't care. You know? And one thing I know is I'm better than I was before I went in there. So, but I'm glad you were able to get back to hiking too. That's really hard when you have an injury that keeps you out of something for that long.
Oh, yeah.
You know, it's hard to
ever get back
to it. So I'm glad you
have. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So let me ask you, what do you teach? What do you teach?
I teach English. So it's sort of transformed over the years. Originally, I was doing a lot more literature and creative writing, but the Texas State Board of Education has made a lot of changes to the curriculum in Texas that have made it a lot more difficult to offer those classes. I have a really, really supportive supervisors, you know, department chair, dean, vice president, president, all of that. So they help me to try to build classes that can fit into that curriculum, but it's just not as easy as it used to be. So I do a lot of classes now, and
okay, all right. Well, I do like what you said. I mean, one of the things I think that's very important, and I think you're, you know, being a teacher lines up with your writing and whatnot. I always believe that there's no such thing as priority. It's more about aligning your life, finding that, you know, that frequency that everything aligns and that you can do it without feeling like you're pushing and pulling and tugging at some area of your life. It just pretty much fits into that energy.
Yeah, I think that's so important. And I know I remember a time, gosh, it was a long time ago because I've corrected it, but probably about 15 years ago or so, when I felt like whenever I was doing something, I was worrying about the other things that I had to do. So like if I would be teaching, I would be worrying about my daughter, or if I was with my daughter, I was worrying about the papers that I had to grade that I wasn't grading.
Right.
And it was just constantly like that. And I was like, I have to correct this. I can't live like this. It's just not okay. So that's when I actually started really meditating and learning how to focus on being present in the moment. And it's done a lot of good. And I think one of the things that I try to do in my life as much as possible is create a life where the different elements are interconnected and energize and feed each other. So that's why it was kind of easier when I was teaching creative writing, because I was teaching, like, the things that I would teach the things that I loved, which was really inspiring for the students. And then also I would be learning from those things in order to write about them. And then those would also be the things that I would like to share on social media. So it was like all of a piece, and it was cohesive. And it's a little more difficult to accomplish right now with the changes in the curriculum, but I'm still doing the best I can with it. And but I think when you love what you do, the way we love what we do, and the way people in the arts generally do love what they do, it does start to all become connected, and it doesn't feel like work.
Right.
And do you find that too?
Yeah, I do. You know, I've gotten even deeper than that with my work. I've gotten to the point where I'm really serious about making sure my life aligns. But I had a conversation with my daughter, and I said, you know, it's not about priorities. It's just about that everything lines up. There, you know, you have a time that you do work, and there's a time that you feel that you should be doing something else. In fact, I never say that I have a to-do list. Whatever is on my calendar to do, I celebrate what I accomplished. And that helped me to not be so rigid with myself. And it also helped me to go into this phase of alignment to the point even when I'll have people come to me and they want me to do certain things, or they'll say, oh, you're in media, can you do this? And, you know, I've given away a lot of jobs. I've given away a lot of jobs and a lot of assignments based on this does not align with what I do. And, you know, and I've been a lot happier for it. I've been a lot happier for it.
I'm trying to understand. That's wonderful. I think I'm doing something kind of similar. And if I understand you correctly, I think what you're saying is that you it's almost like how an organization would write a mission statement. So you kind of have your sort of mission and your vision for your life, and then you just make sure that whatever you do aligns with that.
Yes. Yes, exactly.
Yeah, that's exactly it. It changes everything, doesn't it? Yeah,
it does change everything, and it even, you know, it even changes how you think about your perspective. You know, it really changes. So, and I find that I kind of live in that, I live in that a lot better than living in that type of life where, you know, and I think you can get this as women. You kind of grow up with people saying this is what you should do. You know, if you make this decision, this is what you're going to have to do, you know, and then there gets to a point you say, you know what, you really don't like that, you start, you know, you start moving toward, you know, understanding that you do have the power to really live the life that you want to live, you know, so when you think about life, you know, everything really should align naturally with life. With that vibration, that frequency. So that's, you know, that's how I came to alignment, and that's what I, you know, I love it. I love it, you know. So I want you to read. Go ahead.
No, go ahead.
Well, I wanted you to read, you have two poems in an issue of 11.1 of the Normal School from California State University at Fresno. And I really loved My Kind. And I'd like for you to tell us a little bit about My Kind and read that for our audience.
Okay, sure. So I'm trying to think of, I think I wrote this just in response to feeling like such a strange person in the world as an artist. I know so many of us creatives, you know, understand this, but also, again, this one grew out of some reading I was doing too, because I was reading a lot of scientific articles and I was fascinated by this idea that we're actually not just one person like we think we are, that we're actually made up of all these different parts and, you know, the bacteria and all these different things, but also, you know, I was reading about how they say that even sometimes the cells or the DNA of another individual are absorbed into us. Like it could be our mother, or the mother could have part of the child's DNA, or a twin that was absorbed. But there are all these things that go on that sort of made me start questioning, like, you know, what and who are we really? And that it's not exactly what we think. Also I was, you know, looking at just things felt a little difficult at the time that I wrote this poem. I think this was probably shortly after Trump came in, and that was devastating. So I was like, you know, and I think also at this time I went through a brief period where like everything was going wrong in my life for like 2 weeks or something, and I wrote this period this poem during that period. It was like one of those things where you're like saying like, don't even ask yourself what else could happen, because you just don't want to know. You know what I mean? It's like it's the kind of thing where like, you know, you get a flat tire, and then you get home and your cat has thrown up all over the house, and it's just like all day, every day, stuff like this is going on for like, you know, 2 weeks. So, but luckily that that period of time is over. So, and I think some people, I mean, most of the people who hear or read this poem relate to it, and then there is the occasional person who hears it and says, oh, gosh, oh, I'm so sad that you feel that way. How can I help you? And I just want to say, you know, this poem, yes, I was down and feeling the difficulty of life, but also it's an attempt at being humorous about that, too. I'm not, like, in danger of doing any harm to myself or anything. So, okay, so my kind. My life is burning. That's what I mean when they ask how I am, and I say, fine. Rope dangling, kicking the chair out from under me, fine. Flirting with blades, fine. Looking for Pallas Athena in my pancake, fine. Why would she visit that twerp Telemachus and not me? In my spare time, I'm building a death out of sad songs and leftover microwavable food. I'm building a life out of sad songs, good friends, and leftover microwavable food. It occurs to me that I may be my own soulmate. That's how I've ended up in this body alone. But science says the self is not so simple. I'm a mosaic of viruses, bacteria, and likely other people. All of us making decisions together. Group hug. I am my own kind. I'll learn to play piano like Hélène Grimaud. I'll see blue rising from the notes. I'll see children swinging in a park by the ocean. The music will evoke everything, a meaningful life, all of this inside a drop of dew. I'll be an amateur bird watcher, a volunteer firefighter, a gourmet chef, a great humanitarian. I'll plant a prize-winning garden, grow a pot farm. My hair is on fire. I'm running out of time. Maybe I'll learn to paint, get a cat or a dog. Something sweet that likes to cuddle and craps outside the house. Something feral and one step from wild. Something that when the moon jumps in the lake, we'll jump in after, howling, in love with the lake, in love with the moon, in love with itself and every other disappearing thing, my kind.
I absolutely love that, Melissa. Absolutely love that. and it comes to my last question with you. But before we get to that last question, I'd like to let everyone know that you can go to Melissa Studdard's website and see more about Melissa. You can actually see her books there, purchase books. And that website is melissastuddard.com. That's Melissa, M-E-L-I-S-S-A, Studdard, S-T-U-D-D-A-R-D.com. Melissa, actually, I had two questions, but one question is, what is your next project for you?
I'm actually working on a couple of different things right now. I hope to have another poetry manuscript done by the end of the summer. I won't say I hope. I will have another poetry manuscript done by the end of the summer. because it's been a while since my last poetry collection came out. And I'm also starting to work with flash fiction. And I have a sabbatical in the spring semester to work on flash fiction. So I'm reading a lot of it right now, and I'm starting to write a little bit. So I imagine, you know, it takes a while for a book to come out. So I'll complete the manuscript by the end of the summer, and then it'll probably be, you know, usually about a year, between a year and 2 years, or more like anywhere from 6 months to 2 years after the manuscript's completed until it comes out. And then probably the next book that will come out after that will be a collection of flash fiction.
Okay, good for you. Gosh, I'm like, oh my goodness, I got to get on my game. good for you. Wonderful, wonderful. Well, I look for more things coming from you, Melissa. And my question I have for you is, you know, I believe that poetry is a gift. I know that for some of us, it's a real gift. For some of it, it's a talent. And I, you know, want to ask you, so what do you believe is your responsibility to your readers or the world regarding your gift of poetry?
Thank you. That's a really beautiful question. And it's actually something that I think about a lot, because you're right. It's not, poetry is not just something that we do for ourselves. And we have to think about our audience, because if we didn't think about our readers, and we didn't have a desire to really communicate to people, we would just keep a diary, you know?
Right,
so,
exactly.
So it is twofold for me. Well, it's more than twofold. It's, you know, what I want to do for myself, which is to express my greatest truth. And that's actually difficult, because I wasn't brought up that way. I hate to say it, but I mean, not that anybody did anything wrong. I had amazing parents, but I was brought up in this very polite Southern family that really valued being polite and not hurting people's feelings, and, you know, doing the right thing socially and all that, a lot more than you know, sharing a truth, for instance. So I, for myself, I need to share my own truth. For like spirit and that level, I need to also share whatever truth I can. I think I'm going to say that's also for the reader too. You know, I think that we have a responsibility to really be as honest and as truthful as we can in our writing. And that is very, very, very hard for me. Not that I have the desire to lie about anything, but I do have the desire to conceal, or the impulse to conceal, the things that aren't pleasant or good or perfect. That's why this last poem that you asked me to read is, I'm actually delighted that you wanted me to read it, because that's me taking a step into showing, you know, here are problems and faults and difficulties and things that are wrong with me. And I think it goes back to what I was saying at the beginning of the program, when I was talking, when you asked me what I like to read and what I look for in a poem. And I was saying that I want something that I can connect to, something that feels real. And I think when I first started writing, I had this idea that I was writing in order to create beauty, and I still want to create beauty, but that was the overriding impulse, was to just create something beautiful. And that sometimes truth would get sacrificed to that, because if it didn't feel appropriate or beautiful, or it felt difficult or ugly, I did not want to include it. And it wasn't even a choice. I just automatically, you know, left it out or edited it out. Whereas over the years, I'm starting to prize truth over beauty and seeing how they can coexist. It's like that John poem, Truth is Beauty, Beauty is Truth. So I've just moved more and more towards that. And I know that readers appreciate that more. They want to see my vulnerabilities. They want to see my flaws. That's what we all want to see when we read someone else's work, because it makes it human, it makes it relatable, it makes us feel better about ourselves and the way we feel, and, you know, the things that we have going on. So I think that would be it.
Okay, that was great. That's a great answer, Melissa. Well, everyone, you have to look for Melissa's website. Melissa, there's so much more that I would love to ask you about, and our time is short, so I'm going to have you on the program again. Not have to, but I really enjoyed having you on the program, and I would love to have you come back and talk some more and hear some more of your poetry. Yes, I love that.
Thank you.
I love that. So thank you for being our featured guest today. Really appreciate you. Really enjoyed what we heard. So I'd like to also thank my team again for planning the production of A Taste of Ink Live. Our next program will be with author Mark Wallace McGuire, who has written the novels Alexandria Rising and Alexandria Reborn. He'll be here next Saturday, and I look forward to having everyone come and support us as you always do. Thank you very much. And thank you, Melissa. It was so great having you on this program.
It was wonderful. Thank you. And I look forward to talking to you again as well, too, and seeing you on social media.
For sure. Have a great day, Melissa, and have a great day, everybody.
Bye. You too.
sun is shining bright before my eyes. Yes, I'm waiting for the sign, saying everything is fine, and I don't have to worry anymore. Keep on dreaming, 'cause only they come true. Don't stop hoping, happiness will find you. All the joy that you can find is waiting in the magic of a dream. Make sure everything you do means peace and joy for you, and keep a smile for others on your face. And if you run into a cloud and you want to shout out loud, just remember all the flowers rain can bring. Keep on dreaming. Don't stop hoping, happiness will find you. All the joy that you can find is waiting in the magic of a dream. Keep a smile for others on your face. And if you run into a cloud and you want to shout out loud, just remember all the flowers rain can bring. Keep on dreaming, 'cause only they come true. I said, all the joy that you can find is waiting in the magic of a dream. Keep on dreaming.